This is The Guardian.
I'm Noor Haidar, coming to you from Gadigal land. And this is The Full Story, Newsroom Edition, where Guardian editors discuss the news of the week.
This bloke thinks he's above the Australian law, that he's above common decency.
The Australian government is fighting a legal battle with one of the world's biggest social media platforms and its controversial owner, Elon Musk.
A good sign as to whether there is free speech is someone you don't like allowed to say something you don't like. And if that is the case, then we have free speech.
But X is not the only social media platform preparing to face off with the Australian government. A showdown with Mark Zuckerberg's Meta is looming after the company said it would stop paying Australian publishers for news.
The government takes the view that this is a dereliction of its responsibility to Australia, in particular its contribution to the viability of journalism and news.
And as the United States moves towards a TikTok ban, there are some who want Australia to do the same. Today, I'm talking to Editor-in-Chief Lenore Taylor and Deputy Editor Patrick Keneally about the trouble with regulating these global social media giants and how it'll affect the future of journalism. It's Friday, the 26th of April.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good morning, Lenore.
Morning, Noor.
Hi, Patrick.
Morning.
So, Lenore, we talked about Elon Musk's feud with the federal government on the show yesterday, but there's a bigger battle playing out around the world around how to regulate social media platforms, not just X, but Meta and Facebook. What's happening?
Gosh, it's hard to know where to start. Like, honestly, it is. It's so big. I mean, digital platforms have become so big, and their effect on our lives, on political systems, on our brains, on our mental health. I mean, it's all become so profound. And the platforms, are supranational. But the only thing we really have to regulate them or deal with them is individual national governments. And those national governments are starting to look at regulation for a whole bunch of different reasons because of fears about disinformation and the impact of that on democracy, because of fears about just the inability to have civilized discourse, because of quite real fears about spread of hateful, dangerous criminal material online, which is kind of outside the reach of the law, because of fears about impacts on children. You know, because of the pervasiveness of platforms, the fears and concerns about them are very, very broad. But then on the other hand, there are very reasonable questions about freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And governments are really grappling with this. And they're also grappling with the extent to which they even can regulate platforms which are bigger than them and broader than them, and which are probably more entwined in people's daily lives than governments are. So it is a really big problem that the whole world is grappling with. But in Australia this week, it did play out most vehemently, most prominently with the Australian government's fight with X and Elon Musk.
Yeah, just on that, Patrick, the government asked Elon Musk's platform X to remove the videos of the stabbing attack at Wakely, but instead it only blocked them from being viewed here.
I think the eSafety Commissioner and the government and the opposition and the crossbench and many others are concerned that this is basically X doing whatever the hell it likes and basically saying you can't touch us, there's nothing you can do. The eSafety Commission went to court on Monday to get an order forcing X to comply with this. But again, it goes back to what Lenore was saying. This is, you know, a company which is based in the US, has a very limited footprint in Australia. It's supranational. Where are the limits of what the, you know, Australian court system and the Australian justice system can do to a company that really has very little presence here?
And I think there are a bunch of questions about this, right, Pat? Like, should the government have those kinds of powers over platforms? And as you say, can they actually exercise them and what ramifications does that have? Because, you know, I think in Australia there's quite wide support for the government having some powers in the case of extreme violence like this. They're arguing that any ability to access that footage will incite violence. And, you know, I think a lot of Australians would support this. Like, I don't think this is a really terrific hill from which Elon Musk is staging his, you know, freedom of speech fight. But I do kind of have concerns in general terms about the idea of governments not just geo-blocking something in their own territory, but also saying it can't be accessed anywhere in the world, because there's no supranational arbiter of who gets to decide that. So, like, what if the Chinese government said that, I don't know, every image, social media image of mistreatment of Uyghurs should be blocked in the whole world? I mean, they do their best to suppress such images anyway, but like, just say, or, you know, I don't know, the Iranian government says you can't see any images anywhere in the world of human rights violations because that could incite, you know, disquiet or discontent in Iran. Or, God help us, like a re-elected Trump administration say nowhere in the world can you see images of civil unrest in America because that could sort of further the civil unrest in America. Like, I think we have to think about it a bit more broadly than our immediate emotional reaction to the horrible things that have happened here. I mean, I'm not a free speech absolutist like Elon Musk.
A good sign as to whether there is free speech is someone you don't like allowed to say something you don't like. And if that is the case, then we have free speech.
But I do think there are kind of bigger questions here.
And we don't have the same protections in Australia about free speech that they do in the US, for example.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
A US court would never be able, we wouldn't even consider making that type of order against a social media platform to force them to remove content, because there's very little chance that it would get anywhere with their free speech protections. But for an Australian court to be making those orders for it to be banned overseas, yeah, raises a whole lot of issues around those kind of questions.
Separate to the circulation of graphic content after Bondi and Wakely, the government's also expressed concern about the mis and disinformation that spread in the immediate aftermath of those two incidents. Lenore, where are we at with some of that legislation that would go to addressing that issue?
So similarly, in a state of some flux, we have a voluntary code of conduct, which was supposed to sort of stop the spread of harmful posts. And Meta and Google and Microsoft and TikTok are all signatories to that. Twitter was too, until Elon Musk took over, and then it got rid of its safety features. So you can't actually report misinformation to X, which means it can't comply with the code. So it's out now. The government was looking into, or had brought forward, legislation to try to make that mandatory, that code, and make it administered by ACMA, the regulator. It had sort of backed off that because there was a big kind of freedom of speech, freedom of expression backlash against its proposed laws, you know, from both the libertarian left, if you like, and the right, the right-wing coalition senators and the IPA and the Christian lobby. So the government had backed off and said they were rethinking it and reworking it. But in the wake of these horrible events, it's now sort of seems to be pushing ahead with it. And the objections from the opposition seem to be softening somewhat, although there is division within the opposition about that. Some are still pretty hardline opposed, but Peter Dutton was on the weekend sounding a little more inclined to consider it.
And Pat, could the government end up encountering the same problems that it has with the Elon Musk case? You know, how do you contain information to a nation state's borders?
Look, they absolutely could face similar problems if it were to get to a court. I think what this shows is the benefits of a voluntary kind of industry-wide approach where they make agreements in the public interest to block certain types of harmful content, where they respond to user feedback when people come across objectionable material. Those kind of approaches work really well.
But what if X just says, no, we're not going to do it? Like, that's a problem.
And then when you get to a legal point, X remains saying, we're not going to do it. I think, you know, the way ideally to do it is to get people inside the tent and to get some kind of agreement around it, even if it's not perfect. Once you get to a legal process, things get incredibly bogged down. And, you know, we've been arguing about this for more than a week now, and that material has stayed online. You know, you contrast that with the Christchurch attack. There were some, you know, horrific videos of that on social media platforms at the time. But that happened in an era where, again, it wasn't perfect, but there were at least moderators there. You could report things. Things would get actioned. Material was taken offline a lot more quickly than what has happened in this instance.
There were some other problems, I thought, with that draft bill. For example, it defined any content that was authorised by a government as being automatically excluded. So by definition, it said governments could not produce misinformation or disinformation, which I find slightly problematic in principle. And also, I don't know if it really applied to all political representatives or only the government in power, but some of those senators, you know, the right-wing senators pushing back against Peter Dutton's sort of softer line on this had better hope so, because some of them are regular purveyors of misinformation about global heating, for example. I went down this slight rabbit hole when I was looking at this morning and had a look at one Senator Alex Antic's Facebook page. And he, one thing I came across was this video where he was railing about a smart city billboard in a park. Bear with me, this is relevant. In this video, he was talking about how the billboard showed you how often the park barbecues were being used. And so he said in what he predicted would be a future climate lockdown, where citizens had been told they were not allowed to barbecue meat in parks in order to save the planet. He did little air quotes with his fingers around save the planet. Then if someone came to the park to barbecue meat, the police would come and arrest them. I mean, that's an elected senator on his official Facebook page saying that stuff. I mean, we do have a problem.
I want to pivot slightly. This week we also heard from the head of ASIO, Mike Burgess.
Under law, all of us have a right to do many things up to a point. Privacy is important, but not absolute.
And he was urging social media giants to work with authorities, particularly when it comes to accessing encrypted messages.
You lose that privilege if you engage in criminal conduct or threats to our security.
Lenore, what did you make of his remarks?
Look, I think it's interesting. Burgess and the AFP Commissioner, Rhys Kershaw, were basically saying they were asking tech companies to not stand in the way or to allow them to implement existing powers in limited circumstances. And they gave the example of investigations into Australians who were allegedly part of some sort of racist extremist network and who were using encrypted chats, end-to-end encrypted chats, to communicate with extremists, as they put it, overseas, to discuss how to provoke a race war. Now, you know, I think many Australians would think that giving the authorities, giving the AFP the power to look at that kind of material might be reasonable. But I think it goes back to our earlier discussion about where you draw the line and how carefully you draw the line. Because, you know, but while most people might be okay with that example, the AFP investigates a lot of things. Like sometimes they raid media organisations, for example, and most journalists I know, most politicians I know, most lawyers I know use end-to-end encryption. So, you know, again, I think it's one of those situations where we have to proceed with, you know, with caution, with real caution.
And I think there's a couple of aspects of encryption that make that a really difficult prospect. So the first one is that there's actually no technical way WhatsApp or other messaging, encrypted messaging companies like Signal, to allow the AFP to get access in a way that will not also weaken the overall encryption for everybody. And the point that people like Tim Cook at Apple, you know, they had a fight with the FBI almost a decade ago after the San Bernardino attacks, where the FBI wanted access to the phones of one of the terrorists in that attack. He said, you know, there is no way that we can allow you to do this that will not also allow criminals, cyber hackers, and all these other people to get into encrypted chats as well. And I think it's interesting, recently we've had a whole spate of stories about people getting scammed via email when they've gone to put a deposit on either a house or a car, and they've lost tens of thousands or sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars because they're not using encrypted methods of communication. There is a reason why people are favoring these, is because they're secure and they're safe. So you've got to be careful there when you start messing around with it.
I want to ask about how journalism stands to be affected by some of these questions. In Canada, Facebook, its parent company, Meta, has blocked news from that platform. There is a possibility that we could see that happen here, Lenore, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. So they blocked news in Canada because Canada was trying to sort of more or less follow the example of Australia. About 3 years ago, the then Australian government legislated the News Media Bargaining Code, which was an attempt to force the platforms, in this case it was Google and Facebook, to pay news organisations for the value that they derived from having news on their platforms. And most of the news organisations in Australia, including us, did deals with Google and Meta. The Meta deals are about to expire, and Meta's saying they're basically not going to renew them. And the government is saying to Meta, well, we've got this law and we're going to try to enforce it. The problem that I see in this showdown that really is kind of coming between the government and Meta, and the government's saying basically the right things. They want to protect journalism. They want media companies to sort of get value or get compensated for the value of their product. But under the law, the powers that the government has is to designate Meta to force them to do the deal. So then either, as you say, Meta will just stop all news on Instagram and Facebook, or it could say, all right, we'll go to the arbitration as is designated under the law. But Meta's been breaking up with news and politics for a really long time. They have been deprecating news on their platforms. They basically are trying to not show news and to not particularly not show political news on their platforms for quite some time. So even if they were to go to the negotiating table with the news companies, the value exchange would be pretty small because they're just not putting news in a prominent position on their platforms anymore. And in a way, that's kind of the problem, because a lot of people get their news and information from Facebook and Instagram. So it's a problem for news organisations, but it's kind of a problem for the political debate as well.
Mm. Pat, what happens if news disappears off people's feeds?
Well, the experience in Canada when Facebook banned news from the platform was quite instructive, I think. There was a media academic who said a real-world newsless Facebook turned out to be much more toxic than I had even anticipated. And the reason for that is because once you got rid of all the legitimate mainstream news organisations off Facebook in Canada, what filled the void was sort of viral content producers. And particularly in the news space, the bits of content that would succeed were the most sensational and also often the most misleading and egregiously misleading content that would then get amplified and spread around on Facebook and other social media platforms at the same time. So it wasn't a very happy experience in terms of the quality of news that got spread on Facebook in Canada. And, you know, I would not like to see the same experience repeated here.
And there was also a complete absence of news on some really important topics like wildfires or things that people wanted to know about.
But also one other aspect that I would mention is some of the smaller media publications there actually had a big presence on Facebook in Canada, Indigenous Affairs websites, some of the smaller LGBT groups, and that was all caught up in the ban in Facebook as well. And they use those kind of, you know, they very much rely on Facebook for their amplification as well.
Peter Grester said that it's hard to criticise Meta for deciding that the deals aren't worth it. He says they're making, quote, hard-headed commercial decisions to maximise shareholder returns. And he says that Meta's interests are not the same as our democracies. Should we really have ever expected more from these big social media giants?
I mean, they're not separate to our society, is my argument I would make. They're part of our society. They use our courts. They use our, you know, Meta does big business in Australia. They get a lot of revenue through advertising here. And if you want to do business in Australia, you have to be part of our, you know, system of government, of laws, of our society. So you can't just cop out and say, well, it's not in our business interest. Well, too bad. You know, you have to adhere to the law. You have to adhere to our expectations as a society. I don't think that's a valid argument at all.
And if, you know, I would say if they want to step in and try and be the public square, then they have, that comes with responsibilities as well. You can't just kind of say, oh, look, it's really quite tricky and there's a lot of scrutiny, so we're just going to vacate the premises and only run advertising and nonsense.
So we've touched on X, we've touched on WhatsApp, we've touched on Meta. I want to talk about TikTok. We've seen the Senate in the US pass legislation to potentially ban TikTok. What does that mean for TikTok in Australia?
Look, it's unclear at this point. Like, there is no similar law that's been passed in Australia. We're not at that point yet. But certainly the rhetoric around it has been, particularly from some of the China hawks and the coalition, have been very negative, like James Patterson, have been very negative against TikTok. Again, saying, you know, they should be forced to basically sell or they should face a ban in Australia. And there's a couple of concerns over TikTok, really, from their perspective, and that is that the use of user information and the fact that that's been kept on servers in Australia, maybe in China, maybe in the US, and whether that information could be used by the Chinese Communist Party. There's also concerns about how it might influence people's political views, and maybe that's been used by, you know, bad actors as well. So there's a whole lot of concerns around TikTok, but I think foremost the ones that we're talking about politically are those ones to do with its closeness to China.
Is foreign influence, Lenore, a problem with TikTok?
I do understand the concerns about TikTok potentially censoring content that goes against the Chinese government. The concerns about data collection, I don't know. I mean, all of the platforms collect our data and store our data and sell our data and use our data. We live in a data economy. So, you know, I'm not as convinced by that part of the argument.
Lenore, for many years, media organisations have relied on social media to expand our reach, to reach new audiences. What does a future without news on social media look like?
Well, I don't know we're quite facing that future because there's lots of different types of ways to disseminate your news. And, you know, there's still news on Google, there's Apple News, there's other ways to disseminate news. But I do think that in all of this, there's an opportunity for us, which is to say to people, if you really want news that is, you know, constructed with facts and truth at the center of the debate, you can come to the news sites. I mean, it was always a risk for news organisations, a necessary risk, an unavoidable risk to rely on third-party platforms for dissemination. If we can start to try to bring people back to our sites, then, you know, that would be a good thing. I think we're going to be reliant on third-party platforms for quite some time, and I think it's going to be increasingly difficult.
Next, this conversation goes cosmic.
Hi, I'm Patrick Keneally, National News Editor at Guardian Australia. Guardian Australia's Morning Mail is a quick roundup of the day's top stories, delivered directly to your inbox, bringing you reliable, accurate news from journalists you can trust. And it's free. Sign up at theguardian.com/newsletter or simply search for Guardian Australia newsletters.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.
And now it's time for the things that we can't get out of our head. What is it for you this week, Lenore?
For me, the thing I could not get out of my head this week was a Radio Lab podcast sent to me via email by a very lovely Full Story Friday edition listener called Angela. Hello, Angela, if you're listening again. And her email was prompted by my somewhat grumpy rant in this segment last week about the naming, and I thought slightly ridiculous naming of moons and comets, etc. Anyway, she sent me this podcast about whether or not Venus does or does not have a moon called Zuzve, which, without spoiling the story, it doesn't exactly, but the truth and the path of figuring out was very entertaining and lovely. So that's what I can't get out of my head this week. And thank you, Angela.
Patrick?
I was really fascinated by the story of NASA's Voyager 1, which was woken up again this week by sending a message out. It had been sending back a whole lot of lines of gibberish, just random code. So NASA engineers tried to figure out what was going wrong, sent a message out to it to wake it up, sort it out. And this week, even though it was launched, 46 years ago, somehow woke up and started working again. I just think there's hope for us all at the age of 46 or whatever. I'm not quite there, but maybe also working again.
I love
again.
How Full Story's going cosmic.
I thought that was fascinating. And just a special mention to the giant Chico roll as well, which I think we all loved.
You have to read the story. Have to read the story.
Just go and find out about the giant Chico roll.
Okay. Well, Patrick, Lenore, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That's it for today. This episode was produced by Miles Herbert and Camilla Hannon. Miles Martignoni is the executive producer. Full Story will be back in your feeds on Monday.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.